طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. In the course of gathering resources each week in preparation for This Week in Palestine, I read and listen to a myriad of articles, speeches, and presentations of various sorts, and did so again this week, and came across one of Mazen Kumsaya's email reports from Bethlehem. Mazen is a remarkable human being. He is a Palestinian geneticist who taught for many years at Duke University and Yale University, but eventually returned to his native Palestine, where he continues to teach, but also has developed a museum of natural history at Bethlehem University. He is also an activist involved in the resistance to the occupation. Mazen frequently writes email reports from Bethlehem where he comments on his work in the museum and the latest political struggles. He often adds links to informative articles and reports. This morning I want to read a recent report that Mazen sent to his network. It is typical Mazen. Filled with struggle and news of the occupation, but also included glimpses of hope, always pointing to ways that we all can be involved in the resistance. Here is Mazen Kumsaya writing from Bethlehem. It remains a remarkable era that we live in, and it is getting more interesting every day. Take, for example, the poke in the eye that the Zionists did through their vassal president, Donald Trump, in deciding that the date to move the U.S. embassy to occupied Jerusalem will be May 15th. This is a very significant date because that date is Nakba Commemoration Day, when, against the wishes of the vast majority of inhabitants, a Jewish apartheid state was created by force of arms. Before and after that date, the largest post-World War II ethnic cleansing happened. Most of the native people of Palestine, of various religions, were pushed out and 530 towns and villages were depopulated. Today, 7 million people are refugees or displaced people. 6.3 million live under the direct Israeli racist rule. None have sovereignty over their lands. Immigrant Ashkenazi white European elites rule the apartheid state. The 1.6 million Palestinians who had lived under martial law until 1966 and then given some citizen rights, but are subjected to further ethnic cleansing, home demolitions, colonial settlement expansion, just as much as the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. There is a meticulous and vicious program of slow genocide in Gaza. In Jerusalem, West Bank, there are more and more pressures to Judaize the city by programs of denial of residency and recently the escalation of pressure on Christian and Muslims to strip them of church and mosque property by overtaxing them to bankruptcy in order to take their church and mosque property. This week, the Christian churches, including the Church of the Sepulchre, closed their doors in protest. To my knowledge, this has never happened before in 2,000 years. The world politicians are silent, and the Palestinian Authority issue feeble sounds of pleading for the world community to implement international law and also to protect the Palestinian people. Yet they all continue their failed policies and do not admit that they made any mistakes. As any rational reader of history knows, rights are never begged for from your oppressor. Oppressors must be forced to give up their powers. Resistance must be built up in all its forms, sanctioned by international law. Mahmoud Abbas, whose term expired years ago and whose health is deteriorating, wish him to finally retire, gave a speech at the UN Security Council in which he admitted that his authority basically works for the Israeli occupiers. Thus, the first and main obstacle now to liberation, return of refugees, self-determination in Palestine, is the Vichy government in Ramallah. It is long past time to end the charade of Oslo and create a real Palestine liberation organization. To be clear, Palestine is all of Palestine, not the disputed 22% of it, West Bank and Gaza, for which they have been negotiating endlessly. Liberation, as liberty, not accepting apartheid or the racist notions of a Jewish state. This also includes the right of native Palestinians to return to their homelands. Organization, as people organizing to capture the amazing energy of the 12.5 million Palestinians around the world. That requires participatory democracy, not a clique of comprador elites. Term limits of 6 to 8 years are a good idea for all leaders. Every day here, as we work the land and work with people, we see the incredible energy and incredible opportunities. Just this week, we planted over 200 native trees, carob, oak, azrael, pistachio, and worked with children from age 3 to 83. We launched projects on climate change, on sustainability, on biodiversity, on ecotourism, and on permaculture, one founded by the National Geographic. We watch our friends in Israeli jails, like four members of the Tamimi family in Munthar Amara. We miss some who departed recently. For example, we lost Gail Kure, a great friend of us and of all Palestinians. We planted a tree in her honor, and a mutual friend is donating money to the museum in her honor. Life goes on in all its ingredients, good ones and bad ones, people who lie and cheat, and people who help and donate and work and give of themselves. We in Palestine and visiting and volunteer friends from around the world remain having joyful participation in the joys and the sorrows of this world. We trim the dead branches and see growth of new ones. Spring in Palestine is beautiful with a tapestry of colors of plants, smell of blossoms everywhere, taste of fresh winter crops from our garden and greenhouses, and the spirit of people who defied all odds. 60% of our people are under the age of 18, and we work with some of them regularly. We see hope in their eyes. Life is still good. We savor it. Join us as we refuse to behave like dead fish, but indeed swim against the current. Collectively, we feel alive by the effort and perpetuate humanity. That was vintage Mazen Kumsia, writing from Bethlehem, a voice that we need to continue to elevate. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is a presentation by Yousef Munayer, delivered at the Harvard JFK School of Government. Yousef Munayer is a writer and political analyst and currently is executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Here is Yousef Munayer speaking at the Harvard JFK School of Government.
Thank you, and thank you all for the kind invitation and for turning out tonight. It's great to see the turnout here, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I know the flyer said you'd hear a Palestinian perspective, and that is true. And while I do come to this issue as a student of politics and policy, I also come to this issue from other places as well, which is important for me to tell you about, I believe. I come first to this issue as a human being who happens to be Palestinian, who happens to also be an Israeli citizen, who happens to also be an American citizen. And despite any adventures and studies on this issue, I would be lying to you to say that those experiences did not help define and inform the perspective that I'm sharing with you today. So I was asked to speak about Trump's policy towards Palestine and his recent decisions regarding funding for UNRWA, as well as the Jerusalem decision. And we will cover all of those issues. But I want to begin by saying also to the students who are traveling to take the trek, you have no shortage of resources at this university. There's no shortage of information at your fingertips here. Fantastic historians, scholars, endless volumes of books on this conflict. There is nothing like seeing for yourself what is taking place on the ground. And so I'm very glad that you are going to be making this trip, and I look forward, if it is possible, to hearing from you again about your experiences there and what it is that you've learned. So with that, we turn to our topic now, and it is a well-timed moment to be discussing this. If you've been following the news today, there was a speech given at the United Nations Security Council by the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority, which is a rare event. And he laid out in his speech his reaction to the position of the American administration under President Trump and the shifts in policy that have been made since he has taken office, in particular regarding to the question of Jerusalem and American recognition of Jerusalem. But his message to the Security Council was bigger than just any particular policy issue. It was a message that asked for the international community to intervene in ways that they have not intervened before. And so, if we are to understand what it is that Trump has brought that is different to the question of U.S. policy on Palestine, I think it's important to understand a little bit what preceded it to fully appreciate the impact of the positions that he has taken and the shift that it represents. I think from a Palestinian perspective, it is fair to say that the peace process as it has existed from the early 1990s through 2016 is one that Palestinians would have considered to be unfair and biased towards Israel because of the way in which it was mediated. And it was mediated, of course, primarily by Washington, with some exceptions for periodic multilateral interventions that ultimately end up being dominated by Washington at the end of the day. And when there are international interventions, like, for example, resolutions that come to the floor of the United Nations Security Council considering questions related to Palestine, whether or not they move forward is based largely on whether or not the United States will agree. And we know that over the last 30 years or more, there have been about 40 different resolutions, maybe up to 42 now, where the United States has been the single solitary veto in the United Nations Security Council on resolutions concerning the Israel-Palestine question. And so even when there are multilateral approaches to this issue, the United States finds a way to continue monopolizing the direction that it takes. And all of this, of course, is before President Trump. And immediately before President Trump, we saw at the United Nations Security Council a resolution that came to the floor in December of 2016. And this was, of course, after the election, but before the Trump administration took office, a resolution that the United States actually did not veto. They did not support, but they did not veto the resolution. And the resolution did a number of things. This is UN Security Council Resolution 2334. The resolution did a couple of different things. It condemned, of course, Israeli settlement expansion as being illegal under international law. And that was the headline that dominated the conversation around that resolution. But more importantly, I believe, one of the things that the resolution did, buried down in the text, was really let out a cry of desperation, the last gasps of the two-state solution as it relates to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And there it said that urgent steps had to be taken within a defined period of time to salvage the two-state solution. And so this is the context in which the transition from what has been, let's call it, conventional peace process policy, again, in the view of Palestinians, very much already biased towards Israel, to Trump peace process policy, which is something very different. So what is it that Trump brought that was very different? And before we get into that, I should say that in the immediate aftermath of that vote, as many of you will recall, the Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, delivered a very important speech at the State Department outlining the American rationale for why they took the decision that they did and why the position that they took was so important, not just for the Palestinians, but for Israel as well. And what he said in his speech, and I would urge all of you to go back and look at the text because it was an important message at the time, albeit in my view, many decades too late. What he said in the speech was that if there is no two-state solution, what you have between the river and the sea is essentially an apartheid regime. He did not use the word apartheid, though. The words that he used are ones that are much more familiar to our American context. He said what you have is separate and unequal. And of course, as Palestinians we know, and I believe as Susan laid out very clearly, the policies of separate and unequal have been in place since the very advent of the state, written into law. Enter President Trump, or President-elect Trump at this point. We had indications of where President Trump's policy was going to go. The indications, of course, came from things that he said, and also the people that he put around him. Among the things that he said at during the campaign, for example, among the many, many different problematic things that he said, was a very sort of standard right-of-center approach to the Israeli-Palestinian issue delivered at the annual AIPAC convening in the summer. But it was after that that we began to understand a little bit more about exactly what his approach was going to be and who he was going to be surrounding himself with. In particular, his advisors on Israel, Jason Greenblatt and David Friedman. And if anyone is familiar with these two characters, you will know that they are not only very close to the politics of the Israeli right, but in many ways, the fringe of the Israeli right. And if you have followed the David Friedman saga, you will know, for example, that Friedman was not just an activist, a pro-settlement activist, but actually participated in the financing of Israeli settlements deep inside the West Bank, including some of the most ideological settlements and settlements that are really central to the vision of the settler movement, which I think is important. And if you followed his writings in the right-wing fringe outlets in which he was publishing in Israel, you will have seen him argue essentially that there is no need for Palestinians to have equal rights. And also that Jews who disagree with Israel's policies, liberal Jews, essentially are equal to collaborators with the Nazis. So this is the person that is advising Donald Trump on Israel policy and was the first person who he named to a appointment as ambassador. And, of course, named him as ambassador to Israel. So we had a sense of where this was going. But it was not really clear what the specific policy shifts were going to be. So about a year ago, around this time, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, came to the White House to visit, was, I believe, the first foreign leader after Theresa May to come to the United States, was embraced, of course, with open arms by President Trump shortly after the United States abstained on that veto. And standing beside Prime Minister Netanyahu, Donald Trump said something that many people found perhaps bizarre, funny at the time, maybe reflective of his, shall we say, lack of education on this issue. And he essentially said, well, our policy is one state, two state, whatever they want. Well, you know, whatever they want is good. And it was, because of our familiarity with Donald Trump, it was very easy, of course, to dismiss this as a sort of Trumpism, if you will, as ignorance toward the issue. But I would say a couple things. First of all, anytime the President of the United States says something when it comes to policy, it is not insignificant, even if it is not intentional. But also, what we heard from Donald Trump is in many ways a continuation of previous American policy. And what I mean by that is the last administration sent out this call of desperation for the two-state solution. The next administration is starting to say, well, maybe time's up. Now, where are we going? I'm sure Palestinians have a very different vision than what Donald Trump and some of his advisors have. But the recognition that time is up, I think, is an important one to underscore. Second, it is a recognition of the reality that the parties themselves are no longer on the same page when it comes to the outcome of the negotiations, the goal of the negotiations. There was a time when the Israeli government at least played along with the notion that they desired a two-state solution. But I think it's very clear now that the current Israeli government, which has been in power for a number of years, and governments like it have been in power for a number of years, have been not shy to say that they're not interested in this anymore. So for the president to say, well, whatever the two parties agree on is also a reflection of the fact that the parties no longer agree in any public way about what the shared goal of these negotiations are. I think that is important. And it's important, thirdly, because it underscores a real shift in American policy, right? For decades, the conventional peace process policy was based on an outcome that included a Palestinian state. What the contours of that state were was up for negotiation. The degree of sovereignty that state had was up for negotiation. But that was the goal. This is a marked shift away from that. What we didn't understand at the time was that this was part of a bigger shift in American policy that Donald Trump would be introducing and unfolding over the period of the next year, and God knows there may be more to come. But I would call what we've seen so far a three-pronged attack on the conventional peace process policies that the United States has put forward in decades prior. This includes this ambiguity on the outcome, which is used to be very clear in terms of what the goal was, a two-state solution. Now that is no longer the case. Second is a significant shift on U.S. policy towards the issue of Jerusalem. And we all saw that take place in recent weeks and months, the fallout continuing, of course, to today, after the president recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, something he said he would do during the campaign, but also something that every American president in recent years has promised to do in the campaign cycles, but don't because they realize how big of a problem that would be for the stated goal of trying to achieve a two-state solution. Donald Trump changed that, and that's important to recognize. And the implications of this are significant because the peace process itself, as we know it, from the very foundation of these negotiations at the 1991 Madrid conference, was based on a set of American guarantees. Guarantees that the Americans gave to the parties and said, look, if you come to the table, we guarantee X, Y, and Z. Included in that was an American guarantee on the question of Jerusalem, was that they would not recognize Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem, in particular until there was a negotiated outcome that the parties agreed on. Essentially, that this would remain an issue that would be put towards the end of an agreement, and only then would there be American recognition. So by shifting this, not only did Donald Trump shift decades of American policy that even preceded the peace process in 1991, he destroyed the very foundation that that peace process that started in 1991 was built on. This is a major shift. The third of the three-pronged attack on the peace process policy is the change in the position towards UNRWA, the agency. And while this is most directly going to impact this UN agency itself, it is also tied to a narrative, an Israeli narrative, that is now increasingly being echoed by the Americans, and that is that the problems with UNRWA are not about the agency or its efficiency or anything like that, but the role it plays in perpetuating, again, this is the Israeli narrative, perpetuating the refugee crisis. So now this is no longer just an attack on the agency itself. And by attacking the agency, of course, an attack on Palestinian refugees who rely on that agency in very direct ways, but also an attack on the very idea of the right of return, which is the way in which this is being messaged and echoed by the United States if you pay very close attention to what is being said and done around this issue. So here you have a shift on the question of a Palestinian state, a shift on the question of Jerusalem, a shift on refugees. In 1 year, Donald Trump completely destroyed everything that was the foundation of an already flawed process. In some ways, I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with that because for a very long time, we were able to talk about a two-state solution for the sake of talking about a two-state solution without actually doing anything to get to that outcome. And as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton put it in emails that ultimately got leaked, a Potemkin process is better than no process at all. For Palestinians, that's not the case. We obviously do not feel that a ruse is going to help us in any way, and we would like serious engagement and solidarity from the international community to providing justice for our people. But for the United States and for Israel, a Potemkin process has a lot of benefits. And we'll get into that in a moment. But what this has revealed is that the peace process as we know it is over with. And even pretending now is no longer possible. It was possible in the past to pretend. Trump has made it impossible to pretend. And now those among us who were holding out, not wanting to confront the reality that this was a fiction, are forced to confront it. And we must ask the question, what comes next? And it is incumbent upon us to grapple with that. So, for those who are not familiar, I want to explain a little bit why, you know, from the Palestinian perspective, the peace process prior to Donald Trump was not exactly something that they had faith in. And I will do this by outlining what I refer to as the three central myths of the peace process, the conventional peace process. The first of these three myths is the idea that the creation of a Palestinian state is a U.S. national security interest. This is a lie. It is not true. It was claimed, particularly after 9/11, as part of the discourse around the need to address blowback in the region, that we have to get to a two-state solution because of that. But the reality is, it's not an American national security interest. It's not a secondary interest. Maybe it's a third-level interest. And what that means is the United States does not have an interest in expending any real serious resources towards making it happen. Unfortunately, that's how foreign policy works. And what that means is that when it comes to making decisions on these foreign policy issues, other considerations come into play, particularly domestic policy. Now, there are a lot of foreign policy issues that rise to the level of a national security interest, where a decision maker, where an executive will say, we have to put the domestic politics aside. This is a national security issue. Whatever the domestic politics are, we have to act in X, Y, Z ways. This is not that, despite the myth. The second myth of the peace process is this following statement, which unfortunately we heard echoed many, many times by the previous administration. And that is this: the status quo is unsustainable. The status quo is unsustainable. The Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which began in 1967, is now over 50 years old. It has sustained in the Middle East longer than Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, longer than Hosni Mubarak, longer than Gaddafi. Nothing in the Middle East has been as sustainable as the Israeli occupation, in large part thanks to U.S. policy. When we say, when our leaders say the status quo is unsustainable, they're not only lying. They're absolving themselves of their own responsibility in making this horrendous situation sustainable. Understanding that this is a myth is central to understanding what must come next. Finally, and again, these are in no particular order, but there are three. Ending the occupation is in Israel's interest. This is one we hear a lot, because for some reason the United States feels like it must convince Israel to do something that's good for it, and feels like it's in a position to define Israel's interests for it better than Israel is itself. That's not true, and it has never been the case. Not with Israel, not with any other country. But nonetheless, this is a myth that we keep telling. The reality is when it comes to the occupation, and when it comes to Israeli interests, there are many different intertwined layers of interests when it comes to entrenching the occupation and the notion of ending the occupation. And until you untangle that, until you understand what those economic interests are, what those political interests are, you cannot figure out a way forward. Until we are able to manipulate those interests, and we have many tools at our disposal to do that, if we are talking about policymakers, you cannot expect Israel to make the decision that it is going to end the occupation. The Israelis believe that continuing the occupation is in their interest. We are not going to convince them otherwise. Certainly not by continuing to pretend that it's unsustainable while making it sustainable. So the message that we send to the Israelis is, you should end the occupation, we'll tell everybody it's a crisis, but under the table, we'll give you several billions of dollars a year and ensure that you're protected in the United Nations Security Council. Wink, wink. So it is for these reasons that Palestinians never had faith in the previous process, and now with Trump here, it's easier for you all to see why. This brings us to the final topic that I was asked to speak to you about tonight, which is what is there for us to do about this? I think it is very clear, both from what Susan outlined, both from what I mentioned here today, and was also a central theme in what was said by Mahmoud Abbas at the United Nations today, is that the international system has failed on this issue. It has failed. Today, Abbas read off the numbers. I don't know how many hundreds of General Assembly resolutions and United Nations resolutions. Not the ones that have been presented and vetoed. The ones that have been passed but have never been enforced. The state system has failed Palestinians. And if the state system has failed Palestinians, what then can be done? Well, as you very appropriately ended your comments with, civil society has a role to play. And it is for this reason, it is because Palestinians had stared at the morass of the peace process for decades, long before Trump, that they decided that the state system was not going to save them. That they could not rely on the state system, certainly not the way that it was behaving at this point, to deliver accountability for Israeli behavior. And so Palestinians in 2005 initiated a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And in doing so, called for international solidarity in the use of these nonviolent tactics, these nonviolent forms of economic action, to hold Israel accountable until it abided by international law based on three central demands: an end to the occupation, the military occupation, which began in 1967, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel under the law, not any of this bifurcation between nationals and citizens that allows you to pretend that you have some sort of equality when you really don't, and a right of return for Palestinian refugees in accordance with international law, Susan so articulately laid out. So it is this movement, this civil society movement, launched in 2005 by members of Palestinian civil society, which is growing today around the world, which I believe at this current moment represents the single best hope for holding Israel accountable moving forward. It is certainly not residing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It never was. But it is residing here in this room. It is residing in rooms like this across the country, where people have an opportunity to wrestle with questions about their complicity in the oppression of Palestinians that continues to take place. And we as Americans have a particular responsibility, because not only are we making choices in a daily basis that are investing in one way or another in profiteering off of the denial of these rights, but our government is subsidizing these policies to the single largest foreign military financing expense in our budget. And so it is for this reason that when we look at what is taking place today in Washington, what has been taking place in Washington, that we continue to believe that only through these civil society efforts can things change. And ultimately, and I want to say this to be very clear, this is not my preferred method. I would much prefer that states in the international system lived up to their obligations and created policies that enforced international law when it comes to this issue. That would be my preference. That's not the case. That doesn't mean nothing can be done. And I believe that if we can work to build a movement across civil society to address accountability on this issue, one day we'll be able to create the kind of change necessary to get the states to ultimately play that role. So I will stop there.
You've been listening to Yousef Munayyer of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, speaking at Harvard's JFK School of Government. Before we wrap up this morning, I want to quickly read one more news story that is reported this week by the Electronic Intifada, and I'm now quoting directly from the article. Israel froze a bill on Tuesday that would allow it to expropriate land sold by the Greek Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches to private developers, and postponed the collection of taxes from church-owned properties and United Nations institutions in Jerusalem. Israel's about-face comes after hundreds of Palestinians protested the measures and church leaders closed the doors of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, one of Christianity's most revered sites, which according to tradition marks the place where Jesus was crucified. The church closed for 3 days, but announced that it will reopen its doors on February 28th, following Israel's climb down. Earlier this month, Israeli authorities in Jerusalem moved to collect $186 million from 887 properties in the city belonging to churches and UN agencies by freezing their bank accounts. The organizations affected, including UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Church leaders said Nir Barkat, the Israeli mayor of Jerusalem, was violating international treaties that exempt churches from state taxes. The Israeli municipality has already seized approximately $3 million from the Catholic Church, $2 million from the Anglican Church, $500,000 from the Armenian Church, and $161,000 from the Greek Orthodox Church. The heads of the Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and the Armenian churches, all three responsible for the Church of the Sepulchre, released a statement on February 25th condemning Israel's tax collection bill and its efforts to change the status quo of the city. The greatest victims in this are those impoverished families who will go without food and housing, as well as children who will be unable to attend school, they stated. This reminds us of the laws of similar nature which were enacted against the Jews during the dark periods in Europe. The denomination leaders call Israel's actions a systematic campaign of abuse against Christian churches and churches now reaching its peak with this discriminatory and racist bill. The church hung a protest banner saying, "Enough is enough," with pictures of Israeli Mayor Barkat and Rachel Azaria, a member of the Israeli parliament, identifying them as the two main instigators of Israel's campaign against the Christian community. What worried church leaders the most, according to Israeli newspaper Haaretz, was a measure sponsored by Azaria that would allow Israel to expropriate the land sold by churches to private developers. A relevant question is what Israel would say if such a move was taken in another country for synagogue-owned property, Haaretz reported. The bill was set to be discussed by Israel's cabinet on Sunday, but was postponed following the church's closure. That was an excerpt from a report by the Electronic Intifada concerning Israel's attempt to tax Christian churches and even the United Nations. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.